Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, how the system creates mass murderers and the government's murderous experiments on U.S. citizens. It's all true, and it's in part 3 of the film Human Resources. I hope you'll stay tuned. Scott Noble's documentary film, Human Resources, is wide-ranging, to say the least. On New World Notes, we passed over the film's first part, which is on eugenics. We heard the next part on management's increasing control over workers. Then we heard the next part on the public schools. Here the film shows John Taylor Gatto, who argues that U.S. public schools were always designed mainly to produce those docile, obedient, powerless workers that the system needs to maximize corporate profits. Education had nothing to do with compulsory public schooling. Then the film moved on to the related issues of competition, frustration, violence, and scapegoating. A thread running through all these topics is scientific psychology, used by the elite to increase their control over the 99%, as we would now call ourselves. One school of psychology, behaviorism, has been particularly helpful to elite control. This week, the film continues its look at the behaviorist psychological concept, frustration aggression. The more frustrated the system makes you, the more likely you are to respond with aggression, usually aggression against the wrong target, against yourself or a handy scapegoat. The aggression seldom gets directed against your real enemy, the elite running the system, the elite who caused all your frustrations. This sounds very much like today's headlines, doesn't it? Those stressed out, economically insecure, increasingly marginalized, white, blue-collar workers. Who are they mad at? Why, the Hispanics, of course. And the immigrants, and transsexuals, blacks, Muslims, and uppity women. Many blue-collar whites are mad at everybody but the elite. The elite who cut their benefits, then closed the factory, stole the workers' pensions, abolished public assistance, made medical care unaffordable, and then slashed their own taxes. Did it even occur to the frustrated whites to bash a Rockefeller? Certainly not. No, let's bash that Spanish-looking guy sitting at the other end of the bar. But back to the movie. One result of frustration aggression is mass murder. This week, our installment begins with the case of mass murderer James Huberty. Huberty shot up a McDonald's restaurant in San Diego back in 1984. He killed 21 people and injured 19 more. He was finally killed by a police sniper. Huberty is a classic case. Anthropologist Elliot Layton has some insightful words on him and other mass murderers, including these insightful words: James Huberty and the like are small potatoes. The real mass murderers are governments and politicians. Amen to that. The film then explores some of the dastardly acts the U.S. government has secretly committed against Americans as our rulers attempted to master the techniques of mind control. Yes, indeed, we're talking about the CIA's infamous Project MKUltra, plus a few dozen other experiments conducted on millions of unwitting Americans. Compared to the Army and the CIA, James Huberty is a rank amateur. But let's begin with Huberty. Comes now our third installment of Scott Noble's film, Human Resources.
facility, heavily armed, immediately started shooting everybody.
It was a local man dressed in battle fatigues who declared, "I have killed 1,000, I'm going to kill 1,000 more." 41-year-old James Huberty reportedly walked into the restaurant carrying a semi-automatic rifle and two other weapons, enough ammunition to last 2 hours. Witnesses inside said he fired wildly into the unsuspecting crowd gathered for a quick evening meal. He fired through windows, hitting people in the street. He fired at men, women, children, and babies.
Elliot Layton, anthropologist.
There's an interesting perspective that comes out of many studies in psychiatric anthropology, which suggests that mental illness is not just a standardized invarying thing like diabetes, for example. Diabetes is always the same wherever you are in the world, but mental illness seems to take different forms. Once a person takes leave of reality, once a person abandons the ship of fools, the form that the psychosis takes is often dictated or at least shaped by the dominant culture. Thus, for example, in traditional Ojibwe society, where there was a belief that once a person went insane, this is the Wendigo psychosis, that he or she might eat human flesh. And thus a proportion of people who, feeling that they've left reality, no longer feeling control, begin to act out the particular form of psychosis that their culture is aware of. Multiple murderers tend to differ from the conventional single murderers. The ordinary murderer is very uniform everywhere in the industrial world. He's very much a bottom of the working class figure. He's addicted to drugs or alcohol. He has no education or professional qualifications. This is the sort of person who, in a fit of rage, kills a friend or a lover. Multiple murders are a little different. They tend to be more edging towards the middle class in their origins and in their aspirations. And a part of their agenda, of their motivation, is that they devoutly wish to join a higher class but come to feel excluded. In the case of James Huberty, the mass murderer who killed more than a dozen people in that long siege at the McDonald's in San Diego, Huberty used to stare from his apartment across the street at McDonald's, which was filled with Mexican immigrants who were seizing control of this fundamental institution, he thought, of American society, who were able to go there and afford to eat when he couldn't. I tried to argue in a succession of books that these kinds of killers, while their acts are deranged and insane, what they themselves are not necessarily so. Rather, they are alienated individuals who wish to end their life in a way that allows them to release their grudge against society for their perceived exclusions. Multiple killers may be statistically rare, but I've tried to argue that they represent central cultural themes. They embody many of the main ideas in their culture, not only the glorification of violence and manly vengeance, but worldly success and worldly ambition, which they feel they've been foiled in. So they're a prime embodiment of their civilization, not a twisted derangement of it. I've also tried to argue that this fundamentally rebellious rather than revolutionary cast to what they're doing, these ghastly killings they perpetrate, are relatively ignored by government institutions charged with regulating society. They typically pay much more attention to real political dangers and spend much less time and energy and money monitoring this small group of killers. Now, I don't believe personally that the answer to psychopathy is to be found in brain-altering chemicals to change the nature of our society in that artificial way. I think what we ought to start doing is teaching people about the dignity and value and the sacredness of human life and teaching people how to behave towards one another. The important thing to understand, however, is while it's interesting to look into the nature of modern society and see its fissures and fractures and stresses through multiple murderers, it should not be considered that these are the primary killers. Governments and politicians are the main killers. Indeed, some scholars have argued that the state's primary function is as a mass murderer, to wage war on other states. And that was how they developed. That's the social impetus for the development of the modern state. So it's kind of disturbing. We don't think of the state in that way, but that's what it is. Hitler and Stalin, between them, killed something like more than 100 million peoples, many of them their own peoples. This small-time, personalized vengeance of a few serial killers and mass killers comes to nothing compared to them. The real killers are governments.
Nowhere is frustration and aggression more apparent than in modern-day military training. In her study of Japanese atrocities in China, Iris Chang observed that Japanese troops were subjected to particularly severe abuse prior to their deployment. They were repeatedly slapped for no reason, humiliated in front of their peers, and reduced to a state of impotent rage. It was generally at this point that they would be given a bayonet and instructed to attack the enemy, who was portrayed as a subhuman animal. In America, the same techniques would be adopted, with the emphasis less on physical abuse than verbal.
Was scared. That's pretty much what it boiled down to. You have a recruit that is has no idea what the Marine Corps is about. It's that initial shock treatment to let them know that this isn't a summer camp, this isn't where people are coming to have a good time, that we got a real job down here, and that's making United States Marines.
My family was poor. I mean, we used to live on dirt roads, and you know, we used to wear sandals most of the time. Or, I mean, humble. You know, we used to probably wash our same clothes 2 or 3 times a week because that's basically pretty much what we had. I wanted people to see that, you know, this is where I come from, and look at me now. I'm a Marine. I come from the poor side of town. You know, so anybody else could make it as well. Some type of motivation for my little brothers and my little cousins, something they could look forward to.
Frustration aggression is one of the most effective ways of managing a population. By directing a person's rage against selected minorities or outside enemies, the true cause of an individual's frustration can be effectively diverted. Yet in many ways, the theory is a symptom of something deeper. In order to engender real hatred against a particular group, that group must first be feared. And it is in the realm of fear that behaviorism made its most disturbing contribution.
Hobart Maurer, he would be called a neo-behaviorist, and he trained at the Yale Institute of Human Behavior. And he was quite unusual. I think his background was unusual, and he was also an unusually perceptive and sensitive man. And one of the first and most significant experiments he did was called a preparatory set, in which he had a human being lie down, or usually it was a student, lie down and be attached to electrodes that would deliver a shock whenever a light went on. And then so he would shine the light and then shock the student. And at that point, several people elected to discontinue the experiment. But those who persisted, he would then vary the experiment by showing the light and then not shocking them, or showing the light and shocking them. He would sort of make it unpredictable. And he discovered that people's state of anxiety and fear actually increased when the shock didn't come, when they were just waiting for a shock to come, or when they didn't know if a shock would ever come. And he said it actually created an atmosphere of pervasive fear and anxiety, and he even called it dread or terror.
We have to remind ourselves that we are facing an enemy that is planning all over this world, and it turns out planning inside our country to come here and kill us.
And he said that atmosphere could be ratcheted up progressively the more the experiment continued and the more unpredictable the shocks were, so that after a while, when the shock came, the pain actually was experienced as relief and almost pleasure by the subject. He called it a nervous breakdown, or what he described in another part of the article as the ultimate demoralization of behavior. What he extracted from this experiment was the idea that there was such a thing as a coercive stimulus that could actually be used to create an environment of dread or terror or anxiety from a low to a high level, and that the scientists could actually, it was almost as if they were turning the volume on a stereo, they could decide how much of that atmosphere, how intense they would like it to be.
Needless to say, A creature in a highly fearful environment will be eager to escape to a new environment. This includes human beings. Maurer suggested that new behavior patterns could be quickly created through his techniques. The prospect of creating new behavior patterns quickly and efficiently became an obsession during the Cold War, when the Central Intelligence Agency assumed dominance in the field of mind control experimentation. During the Cold War, the national security state would take the logic of power to its logical conclusion. Known under the umbrella name MKUltra, mind control experimentation by the CIA would abandon any pretense to morality, leading to a nightmarish search for the holy grail of social engineering, a fully controlled, fully obedient human being.
A quote from Aldous Huxley: "The nature of the universe is such that ends can never justify the means. On the contrary, the means always determine the end."
Coming up on Secrets of the Dead, as World War II winds down, the Allies race to capture Hitler's best scientists and technology.
The Black Book had names, targets, places, people. The most important were the scientists, the German scientists.
Searching for rockets, planes, nuclear bombs, and the masterminds behind them. Each side wants the advantage for the looming Cold War. The hunt for Nazi scientists, next on Secrets of the Dead.
The majority of media on the subject of Project Paperclip has centered on German rocket scientists recruited by the United States to prevent the Soviet Union from establishing military supremacy. Hollywood has dealt with the topic in much the same way, often adding humor to the equation. Seldom discussed with equal candor is the recruitment of Nazi scientists who specialized in human experimentation. Among them were Kurt Blom, who tested sarin nerve gas on prisoners at Auschwitz, and Hermann Becker Freising, who conducted fatal experiments at Dachau.
Colin Ross, psychiatrist.
The American people got hold of X number of German scientists, but they immediately ran into a problem. Many of these scientists were classified as war criminals because of their activities during the war, and therefore were not eligible for State Department visas and could not be brought into the United States. So what the CIA did was create several of these different programs, including Paperclip, and their purpose was to, number one, recruit these scientists, and then number two, bring them into the U.S. while routing them around the State Department visa requirements. A well-known doctor who came in under Paperclip was Dr. Albertus Strughold, who did experiments during the Second World War that were full Nazi atrocity-type experiments. For instance, they were interested in the effects of high altitude on human beings, so they built a special chamber. They would put a gypsy or homosexual or a Jew or whoever it might be into the chamber and suddenly drop the pressure down to the equivalent of 60,000 feet. This obviously was excruciating and caused the person to die. And then they would take the guy out of the chamber, dunk his head underwater, and cut his skull open underwater to see if there was air bubbles coming out of the arteries in his brain. And so, you know, they did dozens and dozens of experiments of this kind. So this guy was brought over under Paperclip, became the father of aviation medicine in the United States, worked at an Air Force base in San Antonio, amongst other locations, has a library named after him at one of the Air Force bases in San Antonio, and the Texas State Legislature declared an Albertus Strughold Day in honor of him back in the 70s.
Whether Nazi scientists participated in experiments on Americans after their recruitment by American intelligence remains unknown. What is known is that such experiments became a matter of routine. Some of the studies were relatively harmless, if unethical. In 1966, the U.S. Army's Special Operations Division dispensed a non-toxic bacillus to the New York City subway system by way of cracked light bulbs. Other experiments were not so harmless.
1946. University of Rochester researchers inject human subjects with uranium in order to study how much they can tolerate before their kidneys become damaged. 1949. Mentally retarded children at the Fernald School in Massachusetts are given radioactive oatmeal in order to test the effects on the human body. 1950, the US Navy secretly sprays a cloud of bacteria over San Francisco. The Navy later claims that the experiment was harmless. Many residents became ill with severe infections, leading to at least one death. The US Army releases a toxic chemical called zinc cadmium sulfide over Minneapolis and other cities. High rates of pneumonia, infant mortality, and cancer occur near dispersal sites. Army doctors study children at local schools, noting the health effects. 1953. The US Atomic Energy Commission sponsors iodine studies at the University of Iowa. Pregnant women are given 100 to 200 microcuries of iodine-131 to determine at what stage radioactive iodine crosses the placental barrier. The aborted fetuses are later studied. 1955. The CIA conducts a biowarfare test where bacteria is released into the Tampa Bay area. A sharp rise in whooping cough results, causing 12 deaths. Details of the experiment remain classified. 1956. The US military releases mosquitoes infected with yellow fever over four communities in Savannah, Georgia and Avon Park, Florida. Results include stillbirths, encephalitis, typhoid, and several deaths. Following each test, Army agents posing as public health officials test victims for effects. 1957, Operation Plumb Bob. The US military detonates bombs at the Nevada test site, northwest of Las Vegas. An estimated 32,000 cases of cancer occur among US civilians due to the experiments. No one is warned.
It was in this environment that U.S. mind control experimentation came into being.
Christopher Simpson, author of The Science of Coercion.
At the end of the war, the OSS was disbanded, and the same personnel really came together and formed the CIA in 1947. And the first documented CIA mind control programs are Bluebird and Artichoke. Bluebird was signed into operation by the director of the CIA in April of 1950. Which is 3 months before the start of the Korean War. So all claims that CIA and U.S. interest in mind control was purely reactive, purely defensive, and only in reaction to what the communist Chinese were doing to downed pilots during the Korean War, all of that is not true disinformation, clearly disproven by the documents. Artichoke and Bluebird started in 1950, ran into the mid-50s, kind of overlapped with and were rolled into MKUltra, which ran until 1963. MKUltra, in turn, was rolled over into MK Search, which ran to the early 70s. And in the 50s, 60s, there's a variety of other programs, MK Naomi, MK Delta, QK Hilltop, Project Offen. So there's a whole set of these projects. And the documentation basically stops in 1973. All programs since then are still classified.
Of particular interest were Nazi research papers by Dr. Kurt Plotnow, from Dachau concentration camp. Plotner had found that prisoners, when given high doses of mescaline, openly expressed hatred of their captors while also exhibiting an increased willingness to speak frankly about their own lives.
The dream of MKUltra was to come up with drugs that on the one hand would be sort of an ultimate truth serum, that you could give it to a person and they would tell you the truth about anything that you wanted to hear. And then on the other hand, there would also be some way to wipe a person's mind clean.
Heading up the CIA psychochemical experiments would be Sidney Gottlieb. In 1960, when the agency plotted the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, leftist president of the Congo, it was Gottlieb who personally carried the poison to the agency's chief of station via diplomatic pouch. A 1953 memo from Gottlieb states that MKUltra Subproject 6 is designed to develop a reliable source of lysergic acid derivatives within the U.S. The problem of supply was solved in October 1954, when Eli Lilly and Company, now known for manufacturing Prozac, succeeded in synthesizing LSD.
This pill could solve all of your problems. It's called Prozac, and it may mean the end of depression as we know it.
A special memorandum was rushed to CIA Director Alan Dulles on October 26th. And an unlimited supply of the drug was now available to be purchased by, and in some cases used against, the American taxpayer. As with the behaviorists, they started with animals. Here, we see millions of years of evolution turned upside down when a cat is given LSD. Soldiers came next. One of the first major studies was conducted at the Edgewood Chemical Facility in Maryland, where approximately 7,000 U.S. soldiers served as unwitting guinea pigs. They were given drugs such as LSD, mescaline, BZ, and PCP, then instructed to perform various tasks. Looking back at early behaviorist experiments, the analogies were obvious. Under the CIA and the Pentagon, what was good enough for rats was good enough for the U.S. Armed Forces. More than 1,000 of the soldiers emerged with mental health problems. Some attempted suicide. No compensation was offered. In a later experiment, and with the full approval of the National Institute of Health, Gottlieb arranged funding for a project at the Addiction Research Center in Lexington. Heroin addicts, mainly young black men, were kept on LSD for an incredible 77 days, a feat described by the center's director, Harris Isbell, as the most amazing demonstration of drug tolerance I have ever seen. But they would not stop there.
Here we must pause yet again. More on Project MK Ultra and other CIA mind control horrors next week. You've been listening to the documentary film Human Resources on New World Notes. This radio adaptation was made by my friend and colleague Robin Upton of UnwelcomeGuests.net. Our own presence on the net is courtesy of the evil empire of Alphabet, Inc., parent of that threat to life, liberty, democracy, and privacy, Google. Alphabet, Inc. is also the parent of Blogspot.com, which is where you can find us. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, reminding you that you got along just fine without smartphones 10 years ago, so what's the problem now? I'm also advising illegitimi non-carborundum, and I'm hoping you'll tune in again for more of Human Resources next week. Vaya con Dios!